thing, but a rooster can save a whole family from starvation. Hamilton mumbled, "Very true." Lasky reverted to his normal image. "Let me call the bank to warn them that this check is on its way." "Surely." Fett took him to the door and pointed. "That room's empty. Valerie will give you a line." "Thank you. When I return, we can sign the letters." Lasky went into the little room and picked up the phone. When he heard the dial tone, he looked out of the room to make sure Valerie was not listening. She was at the filing cabinet. Lasky dialed.
"Cotton Bank of Jamaica."
"Lasky here. Give me Jones." There was a pause.
"Good morning, Mr. Lasky."
"Jones, I've just signed a check for £1 million.
At first there was no reply. Then Jones said, "Jesus, you haven't got it."
"All the same, you will clear the check."
"But what about Threadneedle Street?"
The banker's voice was rising in pitch.
"We don't have enough cash on deposit at the bank."
"We'll cross that bridge when we come to it."
"Mr. Lasky, this bank cannot authorise £1 million to be transferred from its account at the Bank of England to another account at the Bank of England, because this bank does not have £1 million on deposit at the Bank of England. I don't think I can make the situation plainer."
"Jones, who owns the Cotton Bank of Jamaica?" Jones drew in his breath loudly.
"You do, sir."
"Quite." Lasky put the phone down.
12 noon. Chapter 20. Peter Jesse James was perspiring. The midday sun was unseasonably strong, and the wide glass windshield of the van magnified its heat, so that the rays burned his naked, meaty forearms and scorched the legs of his trousers. He was awful hot. As well as that, he was terrified. Jacko had told him to drive slowly. The advice was superfluous. A mile from the scrapyard he had run into heavy traffic, and it had been bumper to bumper since then across half of South London. He couldn't have hurried if he'd wanted to. He had both of the van's sliding side doors open, but this did not help. There was no wind when the vehicle was stationary, and all he got when he moved was a light breeze of warm exhaust smoke. Jesse believed driving ought to be an adventure. He'd been in love with cars since he stole his first motor, a Zephyr Zodiac with customised fins, at the age of 12. He liked to race away from traffic lights, double D clutch on bends, and scare the hell out of Sunday drivers. When another motorist dared to sound his horn, Jesse would yell curses and shake his fist, and fantasize about shooting the bastard through the head. In his own car, he kept a pistol in the glove compartment. It had never been used. But driving was no fun when you had a fortune in stolen money in the back. You had to accelerate gradually and brake evenly, giving the old slowing down signal when you pulled up, refrain from overtaking, and give way to pedestrians at road junctions. It occurred to him that there was such a thing as suspiciously good behaviour. An intelligent copper, seeing a youngish bloke in a van poodling along like an old deer on a driving test, might well smell a rat. He came to yet another junction on the interminable South Circular Road. The light turned from green to amber. Jesse's instinct was to push his foot to the floor and race the signal. He gave a weary sigh, flapped his arm out of the window like a fool, and came to a careful stop. He should try not to worry. Nervous people made mistakes. He ought to forget the money, think about something else. He'd driven thousands of miles through the exasperating traffic of London without ever being stopped by the law. Why should today be different? Even the old Bill couldn't smell hot money. The lights changed and he pulled forward. The road narrowed into a shopping centre where delivery trucks lined the curb, and a series of pedestrian crossings slowed the flow of cars. The narrow pavements were thronged with shoppers and obstructed by several hawkers flogging substandard costume jewellery and ironing board covers. The women were wearing summery clothes. There was something to be said for the hot weather. Jesse started to watch the tight T-shirts, the delightfully loose-fitting frocks, and the bare knees as he crawled forward a few yards at a time. He liked girls with big bottoms, and he scanned the crowds for a suitable specimen to undress with his eyes. He spotted her a good 50 yards away. She was wearing a blue nylon sweater and tight white trousers. She probably thought she was overweight, but Jesse would have told her otherwise. She had a nice, old-fashioned bra, which made her tits look like torpedoes, and her high-waisted slacks flared out over big hips. Jesse peered at her, hoping to see her tits wobble. They did. What he'd like to do was to stand behind her and pull her trousers down slowly, and then... The car in front moved forward 20 yards, and Jesse followed it. It was a brand new Merino with a vinyl roof. Maybe he'd get one of those with his share of the takings. The line of cars stopped again. Jesse pulled the handbrake and looked for the plump girl. He didn't pick her up until the traffic was moving off again. As he let the clutch in, he saw her, looking in the window of a shoe shop, her back to him. The trousers were so tight that he could see the hem of her panties, two diagonal lines pointing to the fork of her thighs. He loved it when you could see their panties under the trousers. It turned him on almost as much as a bare bum. "Then I'd slide her panties down," he thought. There was a crash of steel on steel. The van stopped with a bump, throwing Jesse forward against the steering wheel. The doors slid shut with a double bang. He knew before he looked what he'd done, and a taste of fear made him feel sick. The Merino in front had stopped sooner than it needed to, and Jesse, wrapped up in the plump girl with the tight trousers, had gone straight into its back. He got out of the van. The driver of the saloon car was already inspecting the damage. He looked up at Jesse, his face red with anger. "You mad bastard," he spat. "What are you, blind or stupid?" He had a Lancashire accent. Jesse ignored him and looked at the bumpers of the two vehicles, folded together in a steel kiss. He made an effort to keep calm. "Sorry, pal, my fault." "Sorry? You people should be banned from the ruddy road." Jesse stared at the man. He was short and portly and wore a suit. His round face was a picture of righteous indignation. He had the quick aggressiveness of small people and their characteristic backward tilt of the head. Jesse hated him instantly. He looked like a sergeant major. Jesse would have liked to punch his face, or better, shoot him through the forehead. "We all make mistakes," he said with forced amiability. "Let's just give each other our names and everything and get on. It's only a little bump. Don't make a federal case of it." It was the wrong thing to say. The short man became even redder. "You're not getting off that lightly," he said. The traffic in front had moved on, and drivers behind were getting impatient. Several of them sounded their horns. One man got out of his car. The Merino driver was writing the number of the van in a little notebook. That type of man always does have a little notebook and pencil in his jacket pocket, Jesse thought. He closed the book. "This is bloody careless driving. I'm going to ring the police." The driver from behind said, "How about moving this little lot out of the way so the rest of us can get on?" Jesse sensed an ally. "Nothing I'd rather do, mate, but this fellow wants to call in Kojak on the case." The portly man wagged a finger. "I know your type. Drive like a hooligan and let the insurance pay. I'm having you up, Sonny Jim." Jesse took a step forward, clenching his fists, then stopped himself. He was getting panicky. "The police have got enough to do," he pleaded. The other man's eyes narrowed. He'd seen Jesse's fear. "Well, let them decide whether they've got better things to do." He looked around and spotted a phone booth. "You stop here." He turned away. Jesse grabbed his shoulder. He was scared now. He said, "This is nothing to do with the police." The man turned and knocked Jesse's hand away. "Get off, you young punk." Jesse seized him by the lapels and pulled him onto his toes. "I'll give you, punk." Suddenly, he became conscious of the crowd that had gathered, looking on with interest. There were about a dozen people. He stared at them. They were mostly housewives with shopping bags. The girl with the tight trousers was at the front. He realized he was doing all the wrong things. He decided to get out of it. He let the aggrieved man go and got into the van. The man stared at him disbelievingly.
This ends side 2 of cassette 3. Please stop the tape before fast-forwarding to the end and loading cassette 4. Paper Money, cassette 4.
Jesse restarted the stalled engine and backed up. There was a wrenching sound as the vehicles parted. He could see that the marina's bumper hung loose and its rear light cluster was smashed. 50 quid to put it right and a tenner if you do the work yourself, he thought wildly. The portly man moved in front of the van and stood there like Neptune, waving an officious finger. "You stay right there," he shouted. The crowd was growing as the row became more spectacular. There was a lull in the oncoming traffic and the cars behind began to pull out past the accident. Jesse found first gear and revved the engine. The man stood his ground. Jesse engaged the clutch with a jerk and the van shot forward. Too late, the portly man dived toward the curb. Jesse heard a dull thud from the near side wing as he swung out. A car behind braked with a squeal of tyres. Jesse changed up and tore away without looking back. The street seemed narrow and oppressive, trap-like as he hurtled along, ignoring pedestrian crossings, swerving and braking. He tried desperately to think. He'd screwed it all up. The whole tickle had gone beautifully, and Jesse James had pranged a getaway motor. A vanload of paper money blown on a 15-nicker crunch. Arseholes! Stay cool, he told himself. It wasn't a blowout until he was locked up. There was still time, if only he could think. He slowed the van and turned off the main road. There was no point in attracting attention again. He threaded his way through a series of back streets while he figured it out. What would happen now? A bystander would phone the police, especially as he'd knocked down the portly man. The van's number was in the little notebook. Besides, somebody in the crowd would have noted it too. It would be reported as a hit and run, and the number would go out over the air to patrol cars. Anything from 3 minutes to 15 to get that far. Another 5 minutes, and they'd broadcast a description of Jesse. What was he wearing? Blue trousers and an orange shirt. Arseholes! What would Tony Cox say if he were here to be asked? Jesse recalled the governor's fleshy face and heard his voice. Tell yourself what the problem is, right? Jesse said aloud, the police have got my number and description. Think what you'd have to do to solve the problem. What the hell can I do, Tone? Change my license plate, my appearance? Then do it, right? Jesse frowned. Tony's analytical thinking only went so far. Where the hell could he get license plates and how could he fit them? Of course, it was easy. He found his way to a main road and drove along until he came to a garage. He pulled onto the forecourt. Quad stamps, he thought. Jolly good show. There was a repair shop back of the pumps. A tanker was discharging on the far side. The attendant approached, cleaning his spectacles on an oily rag. 5 quid's worth, Jesse said. Where's the carsy? Round aside. Jesse followed the jerked thumb. A rough concrete path led alongside the garage. He found a broken door marked Gents and went past it. Behind the garage was a small patch of waste ground where newish cars in for repair jostled with rusty doors, buckled wings and discarded machinery. Jesse couldn't see what he was looking for. The back entrance to the repair shop gaped open beside him, big enough to drive a bus through. There was no point in being furtive. He walked in. It took a moment to adjust to the gloom after the sunlight outside. The air smelled of engine oil and ozone. A Mini was on a ramp at head height, its entrails hanging down obscenely. The front end of an articulated truck was wired up to a krypton tester. A Jaguar on chocks had its wheels off. There was no one about. He looked at his wristwatch. They'd be having their dinner. He looked around. He spotted the things he needed. A pair of red and white trade plates stood on an oil drum in a corner. He crossed the floor and picked them up. He looked around again and stole two more things. Clean overalls hanging on a peg in the brick wall and a length of dirty string off the floor. A voice said, "Looking for something, brother?" Jesse jerked around, his heart in his mouth. A black mechanic in a grimy overall stood on the far side of the shop, leaning on the gleaming white wing of the Jaguar, his mouth full of food. His afro haircut shifted as he chewed. Jesse tried to cover the trade plates with the overalls. "The Kazi," he said. "I want to change my clothes." He held his breath. The mechanic pointed. "Outside," he said. He swallowed and took another bite out of a scotch egg. "Thanks." Jesse hurried out. "Anytime," the mechanic called after him. Jesse realized the man had an Irish accent. Irish spades, that was a new one. The pump attendant was waiting beside the van. Jesse climbed in and threw the overalls and their contents over the seat into the back. The attendant looked curiously at the bundle. Jesse said, "My overalls were hanging out the back door. It must be filthy. How much?" "We generally charge a fiver for 5 quid's worth. I didn't notice it." "Nor did I for 50 bleeding miles. I did say 5 quid's worth, didn't I?" "That's what you said. No charge for the bog." Jesse gave him a £5 note and pulled away rapidly. He was a little off his route now, which was good. The area was quieter than the places he'd travelled through earlier. There were oldish, detached houses on either side, set back from the road. Horse chestnut trees lined the pavements. He saw a Green Line bus stop. He needed a quiet lane in which to perform the switch. He checked his watch again. It must be 15 minutes since the accident. There was no time left for finesse. He took the next turning. The street was called Brook Avenue. All the houses were semis. He needed somewhere less exposed, for Christ's sake. He couldn't switch plates in full view of 60 nosy housewives. He took another turn, and another, and found a service road behind a little row of shops. He pulled in and stopped. There were garages and garbage cans and the back doors through which goods were delivered to the stores. It was the best he could hope for. He climbed over the seat into the back of the van. It was very hot. He sat on one of the money chests and pulled the overalls up his legs. Jesus, he was nearly there. "Give me a couple more minutes," he thought. It was almost a prayer. He stood up, bending over, and shrugged into the garment. "If I'd blown it, Tony would have slit my throat," he thought. He shuddered. Tony Cox was a hard bastard. He had a bit of a kink about punishment. Jesse zipped up the overalls. He knew about eyewitness descriptions. The police would by now be looking for a very big, vicious-looking character with desperate eyes, wearing an orange shirt and jeans. Anyone actually looking at Jesse would just see a mechanic. He picked up the trade plates. The string had gone. He must have dropped it. He looked around the floor. Damn, there was always a piece of rope floating around on the floor of a van. He opened the toolbox and found a length of oily string tied around the jack. He got out and went to the front of the van. He worked carefully, afraid to botch the job by hurrying. He tied the red and white trade plate over the original license plate, just as garages usually did when taking a commercial vehicle for a road test. He stood back and examined his work. It looked fine. He went to the rear of the van and repeated the job on the back plate. It was done. He breathed more easily. Changing the plates, then? Jesse jumped and turned. His heart sank. The voice belonged to a policeman. For Jesse, it was the last straw. He could think of no more wrinkles, no more plausible lies, no more ruses. His instincts deserted him. He did not have a single thing to say. The copper walked toward him. He was quite young, with ginger sideburns and a freckled nose. Travel? Jesse was amazed to see him smile. A ray of hope penetrated his petrified brain. He found his tongue. "Plates work loose," he said. "Just tighten them up." The copper nodded. "I used to drive one of these," he said conversationally. "Easier than driving a car. Lovely jobs." It crossed Jesse's mind that the man might be playing a sadistic cat-and-mouse game, knowing perfectly well that Jesse was the driver of the hit-and-run van, but pretending ignorance so as to shock him at the last minute. "Easy when they're running right," he said. The sweat on his face felt cold. "Well, you've done it now. On your way, you're blocking the road." Like a sleepwalker, Jesse climbed into the cab and started the engine. Where was the copper's car? Did he have his radio switched off? Had the overalls and the trade plates fooled him? If he were to walk around to the front of the van and see the dent made by the bumper of the Marina... Jesse eased his foot off the clutch and drove slowly along the service road. He stopped at the end and looked both ways. In his wing mirror, he saw the policeman at the far end getting into a patrol car. Jesse pulled into the road, and the patrol car was lost from view. He wiped his brow. He was trembling. "Gosh, darn it, crows," he breathed. Chapter 21. Evan Jones was drinking whiskey before lunch for the first time in his life. There was a reason. He had a code, and he had broken it. Also, for the first time. He was explaining this to his friend, Arnie Matthews, but he was not doing too well, for he was unused to whiskey, and the first double was already reaching his brain. "It's my upbringing, see?" he said in his musical Welsh accent. "Strict chapel. We lived by the book. Now a man can exchange one chord for another, but he can't shake the habit of obedience. See?"
"I see," said Arnie, who did not see at all.
Evan was manager of the London branch of the Cotton Bank of Jamaica, and Arnie was a senior actuary at Fire and General Marine Insurance. And they lived in adjoining mock Tudor houses in Woking, Surrey. Their friendship was shallow, but permanent. "Bankers have a code," Evan continued. "Do you know, it caused quite a stir when I told my parents I wanted to be a banker. In South Wales, the grammar school boys are expected to become teachers, or ministers, or coal board clerks, or trade union officials, but not bankers." "My mother didn't even know what an actuary was," said Arnie sympathetically, missing the point. "I'm not talking about the principles of good banking, the law of the least risk, the collateral to more than cover the loan, higher interest for longer term. I don't mean all that." "No." Arnie now had no idea what Evan did mean, but he sensed that Evan was going to be indiscreet, and, like everyone in the city, he enjoyed the indiscretions of others. "Have another?" He picked up the glasses. Evan nodded assent and watched Arnie go to the bar. The two of them often met in the lounge of Pollard's before catching the train home together. Evan liked the plush seats and the quiet and the faintly servile barmen. He had no time for the newer kind of pub that was springing up in the square mile, trendy, crowded cellars with loud music for the long-haired whiz kids in their three-piece suits and gaudy ties, drinking lager in pints or continental aperitifs. "I'm talking about integrity," Evan resumed when Arnie came back. "A banker can be a fool and survive if he's straight, but if he hasn't got integrity..." "Absolutely. Now, take Felix Lasky. There's a man totally without integrity." "This is the man who's taken you over?" "To my everlasting regret, yes. Shall I tell you how he got control?" Arnie leant forward in his seat, holding a cigarette halfway to his lips. "Okay. We had a customer called South Middlesex Properties. They were tied up with a discounting outfit we knew, and we wanted an outlet for a lot of long-term money. The loan was too big for the property company, really, but the collateral was vast. To cut a long story short, they defaulted on the loan." "But you had the property," Arnie said. "Surely the title deeds were in your vault?" "Worthless. What we had were copies, and so did several other creditors. Straightforward fraud, indeed. Although somehow they managed to make it look like mere incompetence. However, we were in a hole. Lasky bailed us out in exchange for a majority holding."
"Shrewd."
"Shrewder than you think, Arnie. Lasky practically controlled South Middlesex Properties. Mind you, he wasn't a director, but he had shares, and he was employed by them as a consultant, and the management was weak. So he bought into the Cotton Bank with the money he'd borrowed and defaulted on."
"Looks like it, doesn't it?"
Arnie shook his head. "I found that very hard to credit." "You wouldn't if you knew the bugger." Two men in solicitor's stripes sat at the next table with half pints of beer, and Evan lowered his voice. "A man totally without integrity," he repeated. What a stroke to pull. There was a note of admiration in Arnie's voice. You could have gone to the newspapers, if it's true. Who the hell would publish it other than Private Eye? But it's true, boy. There's no depth to which that man will not sink. He took a large swallow of whiskey. You know what he's done today. It couldn't be worse than the South Middlesex deal, Arnie goaded him. Couldn't it? Ha! Evan's face was slightly flushed now, and the glass trembled in his hand. He spoke slowly and deliberately. He has instructed me, instructed, mind you, to clear a rubber cheque for £1 million. He set down his glass with a flourish. But what about Threadneedle Street? My exact words to him! The two solicitors looked around, and Evan realised he'd shouted. He spoke more quietly, my very words. You'll never believe what he said. He said, who owns the Cotton Bank of Jamaica? And he put the phone down on me. So what did you do? Evan shrugged. When the payee phoned up, I said the cheque was good. Arnie whistled. What you say makes no difference. It's the Bank of England who have to make the transfer, and when they discover that you haven't got £1 million, I told him all that. Evan realised he was close to tears and felt ashamed. I have never, in 30 years of banking since I started, behind the counter of Barclays Bank in Cardiff, passed a rubber cheque. Until today. He emptied his glass and stared at it gloomily. Have another? No, you shouldn't either. Will you resign? Must do. He shook his head from side to side. 30 years. Come on, have another. No, Arnie said firmly. You should go home. He stood up and took Evan's elbow. All right. The two men walked out of the wine bar and into the street. The sun was high and hot. Lunch-hour lines were beginning to form at cafes and sandwich shops. A couple of pretty secretaries walked by eating ice cream cones. Arnie said, lovely weather for the time of year. Beautiful, Evan said lugubriously. Arnie stepped off the curb and hailed a taxi. The black cab swerved across and pulled up with a squeal. Evan said, where are you going? Not me. You. Arnie opened the door and said to the driver, Waterloo Station. Evan stumbled in and sat down on the back seat. Go home before you get too drunk to walk, Arnie said. He shut the door. Evan opened the window. Thanks, he said. Home's the best place. Evan nodded. I wish I knew what I've got to tell Mavanwy. Arnie watched the cab disappear, then walked towards his office, thinking about his friend. Evan was finished as a banker. A reputation for honesty was made slowly and lost quickly in the city. Evan would lose his, as surely as if he'd tried to pick the pocket of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He might get a decent pension out of it, but he would never get another job. Arnie was secure, if hard up. Quite the opposite of Evan's plight. He earned a respectable salary, but he had borrowed money to build an extension to his lounge, and he was having difficulty with the payments. He could see a way to earn out of Evan's misfortune. It felt disloyal. However, he reasoned Evan could suffer no more. He went into a phone booth and dialed a number. The pips went, and he thumbed in a coin. Evening Post? Which department? City editor. There was a pause. Then a new voice said, City desk. Mervyn? Speaking. This is Arnold Matthews. Hello, Arnie. What goes on? Arnie took a deep breath. The Cotton Bank of Jamaica is in trouble. Chapter 22. Doreen, the wife of Deaf Willie, sat stiffly upright in the front of Jacko's car, clutching a handbag in her lap. Her face was pale, and her lips were twisted into a strange expression, compounded of fury and dread. She was a large-boned woman, very tall, with broad hips, and tending to plumpness because of Willie's liking for chips. She was also poorly dressed, and this was because of Willie's liking for brown ale. She stared straight ahead and spoke to Jacko out of the side of her mouth. "Oh, chuck him about the hospital, then." "I don't know, Doreen," Jacko lied. "Perhaps it was a job and they didn't want to let on who, you know. All I know is I'll get a phone call. Deaf Willie's at the hospital. Tell his missus, bang." He made a slamming the phone down gesture. "Liar," Doreen said evenly. Jacko fell silent. In the back of the car, Willie's son, Billy, stared vacantly out of the window. With his long, awkward body, he was cramped in the small space. Normally he enjoyed travelling in cars, but today his mother was very tense and he knew something bad had happened. Just what it was, he wasn't sure. Things were confusing. Ma seemed to be cross with Jacko, but Jacko was a friend. Jacko had said that Dad was at the hospital, but not that he was ill. And indeed, how could he be? For he'd been well when he left the house early this morning. The hospital was a large brick building, faintly Gothic, which had once been the residence of the Mayor of Southwark. Several flat-roofed extensions had been built in the grounds, and tarmac adamed car parks had obliterated the rest of the lawns. Jacko stopped near the entrance to casualty. No one spoke as they got out of the car and walked across to the door. They passed an ambulance man with a pipe in his mouth, leaning against an anti-smoking poster on the side of his vehicle. They went from the heat of the car park into the cool of the hospital. The familiar antiseptic smell caused a nauseous surge of fear in Doreen's stomach. Green plastic chairs were ranged around the walls, and a desk was placed centrally opposite the entrance. Doreen noticed a small boy nursing a glass cut, a young man with his arm in an improvised sling, and a girl with her head in her hands. Somewhere nearby, a woman moaned. Doreen felt panicky. The West Indian nurse at the desk was speaking into a telephone. They waited for her to finish, then Doreen said, "Have you had a William Johnson brought in here this morning?" The nurse did not look at her. "Just a minute, please." She made a note on a scribbling pad, and then glanced up as an ambulance arrived outside. She said, "Would you sit down, please?" She came around the desk and walked past them to the door. Jacko moved away as if to sit down, and Doreen snatched at his sleeve. "Stay here," she commanded. "I'm not waiting bloody hours. I'm stopping here until she tells me." They watched as a stretcher was brought in. The prone figure was wrapped in a bloody blanket. The nurse escorted the bearers through a pair of swing doors. A plump, white woman in sister's uniform arrived through another door, and Doreen waylaid her. "Why can't I find out whether my husband's here?" she said shrilly. The sister stopped and took the three of them in at a glance. The black nurse came back in. Doreen said, "I asked her, if she wouldn't tell me." The sister said, "Nurse, why were these people not attended to? I thought the road accident case with two severed limbs looked sicker than this lady." "You did the right thing, but there's no need for witticism." The plump sister turned to Doreen. "What is your husband's name?" "William Johnson." The sister looked in a register. "That name isn't here." She paused. "But we do have an unidentified patient, male, white, medium build, middle-aged, with gunshot wounds to the head." Jacko said, "That's him." Doreen said, "Oh, my God!" The sister picked up the phone. "You'd better see him to find out whether he is your husband." She dialed a single number and waited for a moment. "Oh, Doctor, this is Sister Rowe in casualty. I have a woman here who may be the wife of the gunshot patient." "Yes, I will. We'll meet you there." She hung up and said, "Please follow me." Doreen fought back despair as they trod the linoleum corridor floors through the hospital. She had dreaded this ever since the day 15 or more years ago, when she had discovered she had married a villain. She'd always suspected it. Willie had told her he was in business, and she asked no more questions, because in the days when they were courting, a girl who wanted a husband learned not to come on strong. But it was never easy to keep secrets in marriage. There had been a knock at the door when little Billy was still in diapers, and Willie had looked out the front window and seen a copper. Before answering the door, he'd said to Doreen, "Last night, there was a poker game here. Me and Scotch Harry and Tom Webster and old Gordon. It started at 10 and went on till 4 in the morning." Doreen, who had been up half the night in an empty house trying to get Billy to sleep, had nodded dumbly. And when the old Bill asked her, she said what Willie had told her to say. Since then, she had worried. When it's only a suspicion, you can tell yourself not to worry. But when you know your husband is out there somewhere breaking into a factory or a shop or even a bank, you can't help wondering if he'll ever come home. She was not sure why she was so full of rage and fear. She didn't love Willie, not in any familiar sense of the word. He was a pretty lousy husband, always out at night, bad with money and a poor lover. The marriage had varied from tolerable to miserable. Doreen had 2 miscarriages, then Billy. After that, they stopped trying. They stuck together because of Billy, and she didn't suppose they were the only couple to do that. Not that Willie shouldered much of the burden of bringing up a handicapped child, but it seemed to make him just guilty enough to stay married. The boy loved his father. "No, Willie, I don't love you," she thought. "But I want you, and I need you. I like to have you there in bed and sitting next to me watching television and doing your pools at the table, and if that was called love, I'd say I love you." They'd stopped walking, and the sister was speaking. "I'll call you in when doctor's ready," she said. She disappeared into a ward, closing the door behind her. Doreen stared hard at the blank, cream-painted wall, trying not to wonder what was behind it. She'd done this once before, after the component parts payroll job. But then it had been different. They'd come to the house, saying, "Willie's up the hospital, but he's all right, just stunned." He'd put too much gelignite on the safe door and lost all hearing in one ear. She'd gone to the hospital, a different one, and waited. But she'd known he was okay. After that job, she'd tried, for the first and only time, to make him go straight. He'd seemed willing until he got out of hospital and was faced with the prospect of actually doing something about it. He sat around the house for a few days. Then, when he ran out of money, he did another job. Later, he let it slip that Tony Cox had taken him on the firm. He was proud, and Doreen was furious. She hated Tony Cox ever afterward. Tony knew it, too. He'd been at their home once, eating a plate of chips and talking to Willie about boxing, when suddenly he looked up at Doreen and said, "What you got against me, girl?" Willie looked worried and said, "Go easy, Tone." Doreen tossed her head and said, "You're a villain." Tony laughed at that, showing a mouthful of half-chewed chips. Then he said, "So's your husband, didn't you know?" After that, they went back to talking about boxing. Doreen never had quick answers for clever people like Tony, so she said no more. Her opinion made no difference to anything anyway. It would never occur to Willie that the fact that she disliked someone was a reason for not bringing him to the house. It was Willie's house, even if Doreen had to pay the rent out of her income from the mail-order catalogue every other week. It was a Tony Cox job that Willie had been on today. Doreen had got that from Jacko's wife. Willie wouldn't tell her. If Willie dies, she thought, "I swear to God I'll swing for that Tony Cox. Oh, God, let him be all right." The door opened, and the sister put her head out. "Would you like to come in, please?" Doreen went in first. A short, dark-skinned doctor with thick black hair stood near the door. She ignored him and went straight to the bedside. At first, she was confused. The figure on the high metal-framed bed was covered to the neck in a sheet, and from the chin to the top of the head in bandages. She'd been expecting to see a face and know instantly whether it was Willie. For a moment, she didn't know what to do. Then she knelt down and gently pulled back the sheet. The doctor said, "Mrs. Johnson, is this your husband?" She said, "Oh, God, Willie, what have they done?" Her head fell slowly forward until her brow rested on her husband's bare shoulder. Distantly she heard Jacko say, "That's him, William Johnson." He went on to give Willie's age and address. Doreen became aware that Billy was standing close to her. After a few moments, the boy put his hand on her shoulder. His presence forced her to deny grief, or at least postpone it. She composed her features and stood up. The doctor looked grave. "Your husband will live," he said. She put her arm around her son. "What have they done to him?" "Shotgun pellets. Close range." She was gripping Billy's shoulder very hard. She was not going to cry. "But you'll be all right." "I said he'll live, Mrs. Johnson. But we may not be able to save his eyesight."
"What?"
"He's going to be blind." Doreen shut her eyes tight and screamed,
"No!"
They were all round her very quickly. They'd been expecting hysterics. She fought them off. She saw Jacko's face in front of her and she shouted, "Tony Cox done this, you bastard!" She hit Jacko. "You bastard!" She heard Billy sob, and she calmed down immediately. She turned to the boy and pulled him to her, hugging him. He was several inches taller than she.
There, Billy," she murmured. "Your dad's alive. Be glad of that."
The doctor said, "You should go home now. We have a phone number where we can reach you." "I'll take her," Jacko said. "It's my phone, but I live close." Doreen detached herself from Billy and went to the door. The sister opened it. Two policemen stood outside. Jacko said, "What's this then?" He sounded outraged. The doctor said, "We are obliged to inform the police in cases like this." Doreen saw that one of the police was a woman. She was seized with the urge to blurt out the fact that Willie had been shot on a Tony Cox job. That would screw Tony. But she had acquired the habit of deceiving the police during 15 years of marriage to a thief. And she knew, as soon as the thought crossed her mind, that Willie would never forgive her for squealing. She could not tell the police. But suddenly she knew who she could tell. She said, "I want to make a phone call." 1 p.m. Chapter 23. Kevin Hart ran up the stairs and entered the newsroom of the Evening Post. A lad in a Brutus shirt and platform shoes walked past him, carrying a pile of newspapers. The 1 o'clock edition. Kevin snatched one off the top and sat down at a desk. His story was on the front page. The headline was, "Government Oil Boss Collapses." Kevin stared for a moment at the delightful words, "By Kevin Hart." Then he read on. "Junior Minister Mr. Tim Fitzpeterson was found unconscious at his Westminster flat today. An empty bottle of pills was found beside him. Mr. Fitzpeterson, a Department of Energy minister responsible for oil policy, was rushed to the hospital in an ambulance. I called at his flat to interview him at the same time as Police Constable Ron Bowler, who had been sent to check after the minister failed to appear at a committee meeting. We found Mr. Fitzpeterson slumped at his desk. An ambulance was called immediately. A Department of Energy spokesman said, it appears that Mr. Fitzpeterson took an accidental overdose. A full inquiry is to be made. Tim Fitzpeterson is 41. He has a wife and 3 daughters. A hospital spokesman said later he is off the critical list. Kevin read the whole thing through again, hardly able to believe what he was reading. The story he had dictated over the phone had been rewritten beyond recognition. He felt empty and bitter. This was to have been his moment of glory, and some spineless sub-editor had soured it. What about the anonymous tip that FitzPeterson had a girlfriend? What about the call from the man himself, claiming he was being blackmailed? Newspapers were supposed to tell the truth, weren't they? His anger grew. He had not entered the business to become a mindless hack. Exaggeration was one thing. He was quite prepared to turn a drunken brawl into a gang war for the sake of a story on a slow day, but suppression of important facts, especially concerning politicians, was not part of the game. If a reporter couldn't insist on the truth, who the hell could? He stood up, folded the newspaper, and walked across to the news desk. Arthur Cole was putting a phone down. He looked up at Kevin. Kevin thrust the paper under his nose. What's this, Arthur? We've got a blackmail politician committing suicide, and the Evening Post says it's an accidental overdose. Cole looked past him. Barney, he called. Here a minute. Kevin said, what's going on, Arthur? Cole looked at him. Oh, fuck off, Kevin, he said. Kevin stared at him. Cole said to the reporter called Barney, ring Essex Police and find out whether they've been alerted to look for the getaway van. Kevin turned away dumbfounded. He'd been ready for discussion, argument, even a row, but not for such a casual dismissal. He sat down again on the far side of the room with his back to the news desk, staring blindly at the paper. Was this what provincial diehards had known when they warned him about Fleet Street? Was this what the nutcase lefties at college had meant when they said the press was a whore? It's not as if I'm a lousy idealist, he thought. I'll defend our prurience and our sensationalism, and I'll say with the best of them that the people get the papers they deserve. But I'm not a total cynic, not yet, for God's sake. I believe we're here to discover the truth and then to print it. He began to wonder whether he really wanted to be a journalist. It was dull most of the time. There was the occasional high when something went right, a story turned good and you got a byline, or when a big story broke and six or seven of you got onto the phones at once in a race with the opposition and with each other. Something like that was going on now, a currency raid, but Kevin was out of it. But nine-tenths of your time was spent waiting, waiting for detectives to come out of police stations, waiting for juries to return verdicts, waiting for celebrities to arrive, waiting just for a story to break.
This ends side one of cassette four. Please turn the cassette over and start side two from the same point.
Kevin had thought that Fleet Street would be different from the Midlands evening paper he had joined when he left university. He'd been content as a trainee reporter to interview dim, self-important councilmen, to publish the exaggerated complaints of council house tenants, and to write stories about amateur dramatics, lost dogs and waves of petty vandalism. He had occasionally done things he was quite proud of, a series about the problems of the town's immigrants, a controversial feature on how the town hall wasted money, coverage of a lengthy and complex planning inquiry. The move to Fleet Street, he had fondly imagined, would mean doing the important stories on a national level and dropping the trivia entirely. He'd found instead that all the serious topics, politics, economics, industry, the arts, were handled by specialists, and that the line for those specialist jobs was a long line of bright, talented people just like Kevin Hart. He needed a way to shine, something which would make the Post's executives notice him and say, young Hart's good, are we making the most of him? One good break could do it, a hot tip, an exclusive interview, a spectacular piece of initiative. He'd thought he had found that something today and he'd been wrong. Now he wondered whether it would ever happen. He stood up and went to the gents. What else can I do, he thought. I could always go into computers, or advertising, or public relations, or retail management, but I want to leave newspapers as a success, not a failure. While he was washing his hands, Arthur Cole came in. The older man spoke to Kevin over his shoulder. To Kevin's astonishment, he said, sorry about that, Kevin. You know how it gets on that news desk sometimes. Kevin pulled down a length of towel. He was not sure what to say. Cole moved across to the wash basin. No hard feelings?
I'm not offended, Kevin said. I don't mind you swearing. I wouldn't care if you called me the biggest bastard on earth.
He hesitated. This was not what he wanted to say. He stared in the mirror for a moment, then took the plunge. But when my story appears in the paper without half of the facts, I start to wonder if I ought to become a computer programmer. Cole filled the basin with cold water and splashed some on his face. He fumbled for the towel and wiped himself dry. You ought to know this, but I'll tell you anyway, he began. The story we put in the paper consisted of what we know, and only what we know. We know Fitzpeterson was found unconscious and rushed to hospital, and we know there was an empty bottle beside him because you saw all that. You were in the right place at the right time, which, incidentally, is an important talent for a reporter to have. Now, what else do we know? We know we got an anonymous tip that the man had spent the night with a whore, and that someone phoned up claiming to be Fitzpeterson and saying he was being blackmailed by Lasky and Cox. Now, if we print those two facts, we cannot but imply that they are connected with the overdose. Indeed, that he took the overdose because he was being blackmailed over the whore. Kevin said, but that implication is so obvious that surely we're deceiving people if we don't print it. And what if the calls were hoaxes? The tablets were indigestion pills, and the man's in a diabetic coma, and we've ruined his career. Isn't that a bit unlikely?
You bet.
Kevin, I'm 90% sure that the truth is the way your original story read, but we're not here to print our suspicions. Now, let's get back to work. Kevin followed Arthur through the door and across the newsroom. He felt like the heroine in the movie who says, I'm so confused, I don't know what to do. He was half inclined to think that Arthur was right, but he also felt that things should not be that way. A phone rang at an unattended desk, and Kevin picked it up. Newsroom? Are you a reporter? It was a woman's voice. Yes, madam. My name is Kevin Hart. How can I help you?
My husband's been shot, and I want justice.
Kevin sighed. A domestic shooting meant a court case, which in turn meant there was no way the paper could do much of a story. He guessed that the woman was going to tell him who'd shot her husband and ask him to print it, but it was juries who decided who shot whom, not newspapers. Kevin said, tell me your name, please.
Doreen Johnson, 5 U Street, East 1. My Willie was shot on his currency job.
The woman's voice cracked.
He's been blinded.
She started to shout,
it was a Tony Cox job, so just print that.
The line went dead. Kevin put the phone down slowly, trying to take it in. This was turning out to be one hell of a day for phone calls. He picked up his notebook and went to the news desk. Arthur said, got something? Don't know, Kevin told him. A woman phoned up. Gave me a name and address. She said her husband was on the currency raid, that he was shot in the face and blinded, and that it was a Tony Cox job. Arthur stared. Cox, he said.
Cox!
Someone called, Arthur! Kevin looked up, annoyed at the interruption. The voice belonged to Mervyn Glazier, the paper's city editor, a stocky young man in battered suede shoes and a sweat-stained shirt. Glazier came nearer and said, I may have a story for your pages this afternoon. Possible collapse of a bank. It's called the Cotton Bank of Jamaica, and it's owned by a man called Felix Lasky. Arthur and Kevin stared at one another. Arthur said, Lasky?
Lasky?
Kevin said,